If I could have your attention, please. I know that you've just been served your dessert, and that we're starting the program a little early. I regret starting early. I'm very sorry that we're starting early. But I will not apologize for starting early. Because this will allow more time for our very fine program to be presented to you. It's great to be with you folks again. My name, by the way, I guess I should introduce myself. I'm Stan Evans. I will be the chair of this session. And it is great to see you all and to be at this fine occasion. I would not have missed this for all of the campaign contributions in China. Also, it's great to see so many young people here and such a fine turnout. I haven't felt this kind of buoyant and happy since I first heard that California was running out of electricity. That just makes me feel good when I think about that. This is our traditional Saturday meal function. Our motto for these convivial sessions is memories that last a lunchtime. I'm always a little bit bashful about speaking to the Philadelphia Society with all the academics here. I'm not an academic. I'm a journalist, as you perhaps know, albeit a conservative journalist, which is an oxymoron, like jumbo shrimp or rap music or Senate Ethics Committee. Just a couple of journalistic items before we proceed. News item today that journalism professor Al Gore has invited Democratic fundraiser Dan Rather to address his journalism class at Columbia on the need for greater balance in the media. I was reading on the train coming up here yesterday an update on the case of the National Enquirer. Have you been following this? And it's under new management, and they're trying to upgrade it a little bit, a little better image for the Enquirer. And they're breaking some stories, as we all know. And I had, this is something I saved. It's not yesterday's Wall Street Journal, but it's a previous issue. Just, it was so great, about the new National Enquirer. And it says here, in new owner's makeover, National Enquirer promises all its stories will be true. And this is a great concept. And so that we, you know, if only the networks would emulate that. Now, a couple of quick news items, and we'll move right along here. Just a political update from Washington. I know you've been up here in this academic confab, so you may not have heard the latest, but because of the close division of power in the Senate, an agreement has been reached as to power sharing. Under the terms of this, the Democrats will get to make the policy. We will get to name the airports. On the political scene, I might say that as a longtime observer of the public policy process, I have often been cautious in bestowing approval on candidates and office holders. And sometimes it takes a kind of decisive moment to get you to say, hey, I'm really for this guy. For example, I was never for Nixon until Watergate. I mean, the other stuff I didn't care for, but Watergate, you know, that was pretty good. And with George W. Bush. I'm observing him, the governor of Texas. I'm a native Texan. I'm watching this. It looks, you know, it's coming along. But still, I wasn't sure. He took some pretty good policy positions. Still wasn't sure. I still wasn't ready to say I'm really for George W. Bush. And then I found out that if George W. Bush were elected, Alec Baldwin would leave the country. And I thought, that's worth a vote. And so, unfortunately, Baldwin has backed off of that. And so I think that he should be called upon, maybe some big full-page ads in the New York Times, signed by a lot of academics, demanding that he leave. And only then, if that fails, should he be deported. Now, going back to the Reagan years, which segues to our program, those were the good times, looking back, and maybe they'll return. But even then, I've noticed there are, you know, disagreements within the society on certain aspects of foreign policy. And that was true then also. And I remember it happened at a meeting of the society, and it was the time of the Falklands War. And some of the young people here were not even born then. But basically what this was about is this big island full of penguins down in the South Atlantic, which was claimed by the British, part of a vestige of the British Empire. And it was also claimed by the military government of Argentina, and they got into a war about this. And so somebody asked me, what is the conservative position on this? I said, it's tough. I said, on the one hand, we like imperialism. But we also like military dictatorships. So how do you sort that out? I don't know. Now, one of the great untold stories of that era is how the Cold War was, in fact, won. Some aspects of it have been well-publicized. Others have not. And one of the things that struck me at the time and has impressed itself upon me even more vividly since then was a sort of strategy beneath the surface that did not get a lot of publicity, but really, I think, was essential. And arguably the single most important thing that happened to bring down the Soviet Empire. If you looked at the situation as Ronald Reagan and some of his fine staffers did, you could see that the Soviet Empire, the Soviet Union and its satellites were really dependent on us. They were very parasitic on the United States economy, the United States technical development. And it was by the hemorrhaging of our financial credits and our money to them, and by the hemorrhaging of our technology to them, that they were really keeping that jerry-built system afloat. And certain people who understood these things saw that, and they went to work to do something about it. And essentially, they applied a tourniquet to the technology flows and to the financial flows, and that is ultimately, in my view, what brought the Soviet Union down. And our speaker today was integral to that. He led the effort in the Reagan National Security Council to apply that tourniquet to the financial flows to the Soviets. Some of you may remember the Siberian pipeline issue. That was on his portfolio, and he worked on that and took a lot of grief for doing so, but he was absolutely right. Well, the Soviet Union, I might say that our speaker, I could give you a number of the testimonials to him, from Ronald Reagan, and I might say also from Richard Nixon. But it was the post-Watergate Nixon that gave the tribute to our speaker. But I won't take time to do that. Let me just say that the focus, obviously, as we know, has moved to the People's Republic of China, or as I like to call it, Red China. That's kind of the big issue here at this meeting and around the world. And one of the things I think that the Clinton administration discovered is one of the problems with appeasing Red China is that a couple of hours later, you want to do it again. And our speaker does not fall for that delusion. He does not want to appease Red China, just as he did not want to appease the Soviet Union. Just a few details. He is the president of RWR, Inc., which is a Washington-based consulting firm which engages in financial analyses of geopolitical issues, global debt, equity, and currency markets. In the Reagan era, he was the senior director of international economic affairs at the NSC, where he worked closely on the very issues we're talking about. I was just talking about. Prior to that, he had been at Chase Manhattan, where he specialized in such matters. His training was academic training was on the economies of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and he is now the chairman of the William J. Casey Institute of the Center for Security Policy, where he, again, works on these matters. Would you please welcome at this time Mr. Roger W. Robinson. Roger.